Your job is to tell the truth. That's your job as a journalist. And if you can't do that, you're in the wrong job.
That it wasn't my job, that it isn't our job to be popular.
It was interesting to me how they fit together as a book. I mean, I'm not nearly smart enough to have done that on purpose.
And I kind of went over and said, you know, Mr. Keane, I'm here for that interview we'd arranged. And he was like, what fucking time do you call this?
Welcome all to episode 61 of Behind the Lines here on The 42 with me, Gavin Cooney. This week's guest is Dion Fanning, who is now the associate editor of The Currency. He previously covered football for the Sunday Independent and from there worked at Joe.ie, where he covered politics and sport, among many other things, along with hosting the outstanding interview podcast, Ireland Unfiltered. So let's see if my podcast props can match up to Dion's and get on with the chat. Dion, thanks so much for doing the show.
Thanks for asking me, Gavin.
Can I be among the first of Ireland's esoteric sports writing podcasts to say congrats on the new gig with The Currency? Tell us a little bit about it and what kind of work you'll be doing.
Yeah, thanks very much. It's very exciting. I think The Currency is kind of exciting. Up until now, focusing primarily on business and that kind of world. And I think my title is associate editor. I'll be writing about sport, writing about politics a bit, and then trying to just broaden out the coverage into other areas, and so that it's not Monday to Friday business, that there's a weekend offering as well. So even if, you know, when we're talking, I don't know when this is going out, but like last weekend we had a piece from Lynn Ruan on the mother and baby homes, and I interviewed the American historian Rick Perlstein, whose books, I don't know if he's written, Nixon Land is an incredible book about, and all his books about the rise of the American right. We talked to him last week. And so it's exciting. It's an exciting time. I've experienced that thing of everyone of starting a new job in a pandemic where it's like, you know, one Zoom meeting and then like go back to your bedroom. It's kind of strange, but other apart from that, like everything, you know, like everyone now, everything just takes place. I'm going to make this sounds much. This could be interpreted lots of ways, but everything just takes place in my bedroom now. My entire life revolves around my bedroom.
Well, look, I mean, it's the same for the rest of us. So, like, I might start by asking about the early days because I know your dad, Angus, was the editor of the Sunday Indo. So, what kind of experience is that growing up for you? I guess you were kind of surrounded by, I had this vision of, you know, like writers and poets and bohemian people and men of letters treading through your house on a daily basis. Was it as romantic as that?
No, it wasn't, I'm afraid. There was an element of that, but mainly in the office, like if you went in. But my dad wasn't really, like, he was friends, like his big love, like jazz and cricket were the things he really loved. So like his best friend, like there was, a bit, his best friend was a guy called Peter O'Brien, an incredible jazz pianist who died in 2000 or 2001. And they were, he was always around, and Peter was great. But the, like journalism going back, that was, you know, like the Sunday Independent then, and was, you know, like everybody knows the reputation of it. It had a kind of reputation where it was sort of outside the, it was a paper that went against the consensus in many ways. But it was also, like, I do remember, like, working, like, as a kid, working as a kind of copy, you know, summer jobs as like a the copy boy and stuff in the Independent. And when you went on to the, you know, there'd be lots of journalists doing their jobs, working hard and on various papers, whatever floor you were on, the Evening Herald or the Irish Independent. And then when you went into the Sunday Independent office to deliver something, there was that sense of, you know, it was kind of not necessarily bohemian. There was an element of bohemian stuff. And usually people showing up looking for money, like, you know, like expenses, like Stan Gebler Davis, or, you know, people just looking for an expenses docket for something. And a kind of would an anarchic kind of feel to it. Like there was an anarchic and seductive feel to it. Like I used to love it when you were there, and I always loved journalism. Like I was, and like, you know, I'm very conscious how lucky I was because of, you know, and like, you know, it's especially these days, it's something you feel you have to acknowledge, like, not you have to acknowledge, I do acknowledge it. I was very lucky because of my upbringing. But it did, from an early age, I was obsessed, not even consciously obsessed, but I was just aware of journalism. I wanted to see what my dad was doing. Like, I remember the first time, you know, I was onto, you know, I started when you would phone in stories, and the first time I phoned in a story, I knew how to do it because I used to, like, I remember, like, in the house we lived in Ballybrack, I can remember sitting on the stairs as my dad would phone in stories from under the stairs, which is where the phone was, and I would sit on the stairs listening to him, waiting for him to be done so he could kind of play with me. But that was how I absorbed it all. So from a very early age, I was absorbing it and just drawn to it. So like that was kind of my grounding and foundation in it as much as anything.
Mm. And were your first bylines in the Sunday Indo, or did you work anywhere else prior to that?
I worked in the Star. I worked in the Star for a couple of different periods. And then I think I'd probably done a few bits for the Sunday Independent, maybe before that. I'd done a couple of bits, and then I started working in the Star, and then I stopped there and was kind of looking around at what to do. And then I did a couple of more pieces, and then I met PJ Cunningham, who was sports editor of the Sunday Tribune for after this, but he was in the Independent, the Herald at that stage, I think. And he messaged me and said, did you want to have a chat? And he came in and he said, you need to go to London if you're going to do the job that you want to do. And I'd written a couple of pieces about the Premier League and things like that. He said, if you're going to do that job, you need to go to London. And I said, okay, let's do it. And, you know, PJ looked at me like, what do you mean us do it? Like, you know, you're on your own now. So, but actually I wasn't, because PJ was great. Like he came, I remember I said I'd do it. And then before I left, he came in and like, he handed me, and I can still remember it because it was on the old perforated kind of computer paper, you know, printer paper that perforated sides. And it was about 10 pages of phone numbers. More, actually, I'd say. It was about 300 numbers on it of everyone in football. Anyone you use, a whole series of contacts put together, put down, and different numbers like Roy Keane, Paul McGrath, Terry Venables, any random, Ron Atkinson, you know, there was just this list of numbers, and you know, some of them worked, some of them didn't, but he just handed me them and said, there you go. Which was
who are you most nervous about dialing up on?
But
that
most
line?
Of them didn't, most of them that. Didn't work. I suppose Keane, but I don't think I got Keane through that. I got Keane for an interview a couple of years later, but it wasn't through that. I was going to say he wasn't as intimidating then, but when I actually remember how the interview went, I have to take that back because there was no one, like, it wasn't, it just seemed normal then, you know, and people talk about it now and it's a different kind of world. But at the time, it was just like, okay, this is great. No, it didn't seem normal in the sense that it was a very generous thing and a hugely helpful thing for him to do. But it was like, these are the people you will need to contact, and this is how you contact them. And, you know, when I look back on it, was there an agent on that list? No. You know what I mean?
I am contractually obliged.
Sorry, go on.
I am contractually obliged to ask you about your Roy Keane story as an Irish podcast host. So what happened? What happened with Roy?
Well, I asked him. This is going back. I asked him at the airport, at the Dublin airport carousel after an Ireland game. After Ireland lost to, this is going way back. After Ireland lost to Yugoslavia, I think it was one of my first away trips in Belgrade. And at the carousel, I went up to him. It was 98-99, and he was just back after his knee injury. And Keane had actually transformed and been, I think this was when he first began to seem probably more distant and more intimidating, because he, you know, he had, and like there was, he would describe it as lifestyle choices. I would say it was something more profound than that, but he was changing his physical shape, and, you know, he'd become leaner and shaved his hair, and like the kind of puppy fat and the kind of exuberant Keane was kind of disappearing. I went up to him at the carousel. Sorry, I went up to him at the carousel and said, "Would he do?" I said, "I was going to Barcelona. United were playing Barcelona in a Champions League game in a couple of weeks, and I said I'm going out to that game. Would you do an interview?" And I wasn't going out to the game until I asked him, and he said, "Yeah, sure, come along to the hotel the night before the game, and we'll do the interview." And I said, "Fantastic." So then. Then I got on to going to the game, and because that was the only contact I'd had with Keane, it was like, well, I need to kind of firm it up before we actually sit down the night before. I think it was probably two or three weeks in advance of that game. So I got on the official press trip to Barcelona. So I flew out from Manchester and went up to... Ken Merritt, was that the guy, the secretary of Manchester United at the time? I think it was. Anyway, at some point on that flight, I said, I was trying to get, you know, see Keane at some point to confirm it. At some stage before, you know, the interview took place, I was trying to confirm that this interview was taking place, because the Sunday Independent at this point had forked out for me to fly to Barcelona on the private plane, and I was quite concerned that we'd only had Roy Keane beside a carousel when he's trying to get out of Dublin Airport. That's the only confirmation we had. So Ken Ramsden, he was the guy. Anyway, I mentioned something to him. I didn't see Keane on the plane, and then I went to training in the Nou Camp, or in Camp Nou, and said it to Ken Ramsden, "I'm here to do interview with Keane." And he went off. At some point then, like at the end of training, he came up to me and said, "Roy Keane doesn't know what you're talking about."
Oh, no.
And I was, okay. So then I went to... I went to the team hotel then that night. I went along to the team hotel that night and said, "I've got to talk to Keane myself, so I'll just go along to the team hotel." So I waited and waited at the team hotel, just sitting down outside the restaurant where all the players were going in to eat. So I just waited there and waited, and I think I was there about like 6:30, and I seemed to wait, it seems like hours, like they all traipsed in. Finally, Keane came down with Dennis Irwin. And it seemed like my head now was like 8:30, 9:00. It was whatever, a couple of hours of waiting. And I kind of went over and said, you know, "Mr. Keane," I don't know if I said, you know, "hello. I'm here for that that interview we'd arranged." And he was like, "What fucking time do you call this?"
Did he do it?
He kind of shouted at me for a minute and said, like, "What? This is, we can't do it now. It's way too late. Like, it's not." And I was kind of just confused, because it was like, how can I? I don't know how I could have made it any other time. Anyway, so he went off to eat. Anyway, and he went off to eat and kind of left me hanging there. But I, for whatever reason, he maybe said some. I hung around anyway, and. And again, it went on another hour kind of passed, like it seemed, where I was just sitting there and I didn't know what was going to happen. And then I looked up at one point and Keane was striding over towards me, and I was braced for another like bit of abuse, you know. And instead he said, like, he said, "Sorry about that. Sure you weren't to know, like, how could you find," like, basically totally saw my side, like, "Sure, how could you know what time it was meant to be, you know, how you..." All this kind of stuff, and sat down and did the interview, and it was fine. So, like, that was my first encounter with Keane.
Do you still find Keane interesting?
I know people say he's boring, and I think I find what he's become interesting, and I know it probably does diminishing returns on that as well, but I think it is kind of I do think there is something interesting about him, even in and I guess this is the interesting thing with Keane as well, and it's not necessarily his problem, but he's carried a whole lot of expectation for what he's supposed to represent and what he's supposed to be all through his career. And in a way, he's still dealing with that, because one of the things I find disappointing is he hasn't become, and this is not Roy Keane's issue at all, he hasn't become the figure in football that I kind of thought he would be. You know what I mean? And it's not up to Roy Keane to, but like, he's the same age as Pep Guardiola, and he speaks like a man from, you know, a bygone age. And I find that strange. And I find it, I always thought with Keane, like, I remember covering Keane when he went to Sunderland and the first year at Sunderland. And I was, you know, I thought this guy, this is going to be huge. Like, this management career. And I remember the unveiling at Sunderland. And, you know, you might, like, you know, all, one of the things that, as Irish people, I think we always felt with Keane, like, you would read pieces in English newspapers about Keane, and they would talk about him as a thug or a bully, and all those things. And I always used to, you know, it was misjudged at that point. Like, it was always seen to me, you don't get Keane. You're looking at him. He's an intelligent guy who's a lot more to say and is a lot more interesting than that. And I remember that day of the unveiling at Sunderland, and the English media was there, everyone was in force, and I think a lot of them came with the preconception of who Keane was, and that they were going to be dealing with somebody like that. And like, that day, and I know it's only the media side of it, but that day he was extraordinary. Like, he was so, it was just a classic Keane. He did about 4 hours of different media, and he was funny and self-deprecating. And, you know, I remember making him some joke about, you know, we've got to finish this up because I've got to get home to watch Love Island. Like, and, you know, at the time it was just one of those things, you know, everyone, just this disarming way that Keane could be. And the amount of people you saw there that day in the English media were just like, this is not what I expected. And I thought, during that first full that season, I went to a lot of games that year at Sunderland games. I thought, this is the beginning of something really big, and we know that's not what happened.
Mm. How did you find adapting to life in London, having moved over with your sheets of paper and a whole lot else?
I loved it. I loved every element of it. Like, I, you know, I just, like, English football, like, you know, like so many people, I grew up, like, these places were, like, English football grounds, and I still get that, you know, like, I remember as a kid going over to see, like, going to White Hart Lane when I was a kid, and, you know, a couple of times, and, you know, just everything, like, the hot dogs being sold outside, like, the whole, like, the terrace streets and the floodlights just signalling where the ground was around them, you know, that, just that sense of it, of its huge importance in the fabric of the community and in society. And, like, so that's what football was to me, and that's what I, you know, I used to, as a kid, I just, and then, you know, I know there will be people who say you could have, and I used to go to League of Ireland games, I used to go to Shamrock Rovers games as well, so before the people in the League of Ireland say you had that here, I'm sorry, I was more attracted, I was drawn to, those places were romantic places to me, they were places full of romance, and the names were, they just did something in that romantic sense to me that goes beyond just logic, you know. So whenever, and this, you know, and it's going to places, it's actually going to places like, you know, later on, you know, going to places like Burnley and so, like all those northern towns where football was formed, like that was the stuff. It wasn't necessarily glamorous. It was almost anti-glamour. It was going to those places and thinking about the history of those places and those clubs, and I loved all that. So, I loved going to games all the time. I loved covering it, and you know, calling up people on from my printed sheets of paper occasionally and getting an interview.
You were writing on the pages of the Sunday Independent, and they were pages also graced by Anthony Cronin, who has written the first of your picks today. Dion, tell us about Dead as Doornails and why you picked it.
If anyone doesn't know, like Dead as Doornails is a great, great book. Like it's an extraordinary portrait of writers in Dublin and a certain time. Like if it focuses on Cronin, who knew Brendan Behan and Patrick Kavanagh and Brian O'Nolan, who was Flann O'Brien, and it's a wonderful portrait of those people. And again, between Dublin and London, it moves between both places. But it's an incredibly funny book. It's beautifully written. Like Cronin, Cronin was an incredible writer. Like he was a very good writer. I have a shorthand for like poets where I'd like to see some of their journalism before I assess them as a poet. And Cronin is a great writer. Like his poetry, you can tell he's a good poet because his journalism is so good. And and you know, he wore everything lightly. Like he was engaged by things. There was nothing there was no pretension with him, really. He could, you know, he could move effortlessly from talking about poetry, talking about the books he'd read, to talking about sport, particularly racing, which he wrote about in the Sunday Independent. And he was, you know, he was a very good racing writer for that reason, because he was bringing all his hinterland with him. And, you know, he had a, like, and I might go on to it because I actually looked up, I was trying to find then after I picked that, what some of his writing, there is one of his pieces in the book that John Green brought out about journalism, the Sunday Independent. But he was a fine writer on that. But Dead as Doornails is one of those books I've read. I just read it a number of times, and always just the way it brings those characters to life, and Kavanagh especially, I think there's something so poignant about Kavanagh, because there's another passage in the part in the book where he talks about before he met Kavanagh, Kavanagh was the butt of so many jokes around Dublin, and like, you know, he should have stayed, should never have left Monaghan, and he was better off up there, and this kind of smugness and that kind of example of the kind of collective or the conventional thinking that would take place in a small town like Dublin, where everybody, like, and I think if it persists today in different forms, like, and it's, you know, it's still there, like just that sense of, you know, anyone who steps outside or is slightly different, we still have trouble accepting them for how they're different. Like, you know, except the terms of reference might have changed, but that's that human impulse to kind of huddle around a collective and sneer at somebody who's a little bit outside, it remains. So like the movie, like he talks about when he first got to know Kavanagh then, and just being so impressed by his, or not impressed, he wouldn't use it as kind of as pompous a word as that, but just being taken by his seriousness. And I think he uses there's a line, he talks about how, he quotes, was it Samuel Johnson's line about Edmund Burke, you only had to shelter with him in a doorway to avoid a herd of oxen for a minute to realize you were in the presence of a genius. And that's what that's how he describes Kavanagh.
Well, Kavanagh, like, and I think this story may have been lubricated by booze, but there is a story which he went into, it came out in state papers a few years ago, when he went into some bookshop and like started haranguing the staff for not putting his book in the front window. And then he roared a line, which I believe is like my favorite sentence ever said in Irish public life: "You must obey the law of the poet," which is absolutely amazing.
It's good. That reminds me of the story about Lord Longford. Was it Lord Longford who once stormed into, was said to have stormed into Hatchard's bookshop in Piccadilly once and wondered why his book, which was called Humility, wasn't more prominently displayed.
If listeners were in Hodges Figgis or Dubray before Christmas and saw the 42s Behind the Lines Volume 4 in a more prominent position on the bookshelves than you might imagine, you have me to thank for that. In what way, how did this book by Anthony Coronan and his writings generally influence yours?
I couldn't say that it did in that sense. I would say that I admired the way, as I said earlier, the way he effortlessly, there was no boundary between when, and I'm trying to find the passage that I picked out because I didn't mark it. I marked the other one and I didn't mark it. But the scene I picked out from the book where he talks about, you know, it's on the original Bloomsday. Oh yeah, I have it here. And why I liked it, because I do think, like, I think journalism at its best is as profound as and as powerful a writing medium as any other writing medium. Like, I think it's I don't want to, you know, don't want to pick on poets, but like, you know, I reject the idea that if you declare, maybe this is my own inferiority, but like, if you declare that you are a poet, that you are somehow by nature, by virtue of the fact that you say I am a poet, that you are something going to then produce something for me which is more revealing about the human condition, or tell me something about life that I as a journalist that journalism, say, couldn't match. And there are poets who do that and give you, and the great poets do that, but there are much more bad poets than there are good poets, just as there are many more bad journalists than there are good journalists. But there is something in the way Cronin writes that is just you know, it's just effortlessly moves between them. So, like, you know, in that passage, you know, because he starts it off with the other matter was the result of the Ascot Gold Cup. So, like, you know, they're talking about this day on, you know, commemorating Ulysses and, you know, the original Bloomsday, and then this wonderful story about the winner of the Gold Cup that year, because, you know, the original party. I don't know if you wanted to go into the passage.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, it's just wonderful because he says, naturally, with Kavanagh, Con Leventhal, also a racing man, and myself in the party, some attention was given to this. This is the Ascot Gold Cup. There was a very strong French favourite owned by M. Marcel Boussac, reputedly a great stayer. He goes on to say there was a pacemaker whose name was Elpenor, and Elpenor proceeded to make the running to such effect that not even his own stable companion, who was supposed to win, could catch him. And he perforce went on to win the race himself at 50-1, a record price for a Gold Cup winner in this century, though throwaway in the book starts at 40-1. Now, Elpenor is a character in the Odyssey. He is a companion of Ulysses, who falls off a height during some fighting, as some of our party had so nearly done, cracks his skull and dies. Although Ulysses remarks that it didn't much matter, since he wasn't much of a fighting man nor ever very strong in the head. He nevertheless goes down into the underworld after him to see what he can do. This descent is paralleled in the book by the scene in Glasnevin Cemetery for Joyce's Ulysses. Elpenor is represented by the deceased Paddy Bignam and it was the route of Paddy Dignan's funeral that we were following. Indeed, the whole idea of a commemoration which would involve horse cabs grew out of the Dignan funeral experience. Needless to say, when I explained all this to Kavanagh, and it was necessary to explain some of it, he accused me of withholding information.
The great thing about this podcast is like I get to read all this stuff. So I've never read this book, but I will order it. I've read, Andy Crone did a really great biography of Flann O'Brien that was reissued a few years ago. Yeah. There's an amazing cover on it. That's what drew me in. But I would recommend that for readers as well. You mentioned a couple of minutes ago that you can find journalism to be quite profound and moving. Contemporary journalism, is there anyone at the moment who does that for you? Is there anyone, any newspapers you buy in particular to find that?
I think one of the great paradoxes of journalism at the moment is that while it's kind of in crisis because it looks for a model that works, you have access to more kind of great journalism than ever. So, like, you know, if you look at the writing, like, you know, things you could read, you know, pieces on Trump and, you know, various, and like Brexit and various things like this, you know, you're able to take in an array of journalism that 30 years ago you just couldn't, obviously you wouldn't see. You might occasionally, someone might have a New Yorker somewhere or something like that, but you wouldn't see it like you do now. So in terms of who I look out, who I read, who do I read? Like, when I say profound and moving, like that is at its best, and it's not. And also, like, you know, a lot of the time journalism isn't required to do those things. It's also required to inform and shed, you know, put light on areas that you hadn't really considered. And obviously a lot of the reporting around, you know, Trump and the White House was spectacular for that, because, you know, you got these this amazing portrait of what was going on there. Like Olivia Nuzzi, I think, did some incredible stuff in New York magazine. You know, I suppose in terms of people, like I always read, like I will read Ken Early every week in terms of football, because I think he's a fantastic, like he is, and Ken is a great journalist in whatever medium he works in.
Let's move on to your second pick, so, Dion. American Pastoral by Philip Roth. Again, I'll hold my hand up as being a Philistine. I've not read this. In fact, I've hardly read any Philip Roth. So please inform us of the ways of Philip Roth and tell us why you picked American Pastoral.
After I picked this, I wondered if, I can't remember if Philip Roth has been cancelled or something or not. Like, I don't think so, but he may have.
I'm not sure either.
I think he was borderline for a while there. There might have been some story recently that he. But I love Philip Roth. Like, it's probably dates me, and I might be told now that it's, you know, he's very he's not fashionable anymore, but. You know, there's so many of his books that I love, but American Pastoral is a wonderful book, and there's just passages of writing in it that are really just profound. And again, that sense that you're dealing, now this is, you know, this is when you're dealing with just that feeling when you're dealing with the truth, or what seems to reveal itself as the truth. But the reason I picked this passage in terms of what we're talking about today was the passage concerns the Swede who was a sporting hero of the Philip Roth, the narrator, at the as a kid, and it's just, I'll just read this again, it's only very short, but there's something illuminating here about how we talk about sports people and what we ask of them, and probably why it probably captures in a few sentences why I would feel, and I think why sports journalism has changed, and I don't think it's a bad thing that it's changed. Contrary to whatever daydreams the rest of us may have had about the enhancing effect on ourselves of total uncritical, adulterous adulation, the love thrust upon the Swede seemed actually to deprive him of feeling. In this boy embraces a symbol of hope by so many, as the embodiment of the strength, the resolve, the emboldened valour that would prevail to return our high school servicemen home unscathed from Midway, Salerno, Cherbourg, the Solomons, the Aleutians, Tarawa. There appeared to be not a drop of wit or irony to interfere with his golden gift for responsibility. But wit or irony is like a hitch in his swing for a kid like the Swede. Irony being a human consolation, and beside the point if you're getting your way as a god.
Mm.
Now, I love that in terms of, like, there are a number of sports people I can think of that applies to. And that as sports writers, people are always looking for that, you know, what's underneath, what darkness might drive somebody. And I think an awful lot of the time, it's not that it's not there, but it's, you know, it hasn't been like those things, like they are also like the irony is a consolation, like that is true, like we develop these kind of things as devices to help us deal with our failings and our failures as human beings, whereas sports people, who especially the sports people whose life has been staging post after staging post of success, don't necessarily have that. And I think it comes back to as well an awful lot of what we talk about when we talk about sport and character, like, you know, the idea of sport being a kind of metaphor for life or anything like that. And I think, you know, I think that was a device attached by sports writers to make them feel better about covering sport. And again, it's almost a flip side of my complaint about poets. Like, you don't need to justify it. You don't need to find something greater in it, because it's fine as it is. And it's not a metaphor for life. And it doesn't, like, you know, it doesn't reveal, sport doesn't necessarily reveal, it reveals elements of character. But, like, the things we talk about in terms of character, a lot of the time when you look at it now, you think, well, actually, what we're talking about there is sociopathic tendencies or psychopathic tendencies. Like I remember during the when the two Leeds United players, when Lee Bowyer and Jonathan Woodgate were on trial for the attack on the Asian student, Sarfaz Najib, wasn't it? The amount of pieces that used to be written about Lee Bowyer's character and how he could go out and play during all this trial, and he was able to, and there was pieces written about his character, and maybe it was, and I don't want to, but, you know, there are other ways of looking at that when you go, well, the idea that you would find being on trial for that something that actually prevents you from playing isn't a human failing. And I don't want to, and let's move it away from that case, but the idea that being able to put aside all doubt and anxiety and concern is something that is by necessarily a good thing, isn't necessarily a good thing. Like, if you look at the debate about rugby and concussion, one of the things that rugby and all sports is predicated on is this idea of get out there and don't flinch, and be a man, and all these kind of things. And I can't remember who wrote it. Was it John Magus wrote that, you know, and I took great consolation in this, all highly intelligent people are physical cowards. And And, you know, I agree with, as a coward, anyway, I agree with that. Like, you know, I think the ability to see, I don't know how intelligent you have to be to actually predict the consequences of what might happen in a certain situation. But, as you know, it's not a massive amount of imagination. But I think that little bit of imagination that does that is also an impediment when you're actually dealing with sport. And so the removal of that allows us to create these people of great character, so just, you know, so-called, that never flinch and putting their head where other people wouldn't put their feet. Why would you do that? Like, if other people wouldn't put their feet there, why on earth would you put your head there? Like, don't come looking to me for praise when you do that.
But the ultimate, in my opinion, the ultimate sports story, I suppose, it's been phrased with way too much meaning. Like you mentioned, like Italia 90. I mean, the Jack Charlton documentary was really good, but it did have, you know, Larry Mullen from U2 talking about, well, Italia 90 was at the vanguard of Ireland, leaving behind its past and opening itself up to the new world, which I don't really know about that. I think it was just a very good football team. There's an interesting story to be told as regards the return of emigrants' children and so on, but I'm not sure whether...
Yeah, no, I suppose with those ones, like, if you stitch a story onto something, like, collective like that, like, what is... I think if you stitch a story onto something collective like that, I think it can have some purpose. Because I do think collective stories are important in terms of countries and in terms of how we define ourselves. And now maybe it doesn't change all the things that people, you know, that are wrong with a country. It doesn't give people jobs. It doesn't give people houses. It doesn't do all these things that are required of a society. But equally, those things, like the things we use, and sport is one of these things, the things we use to to escape from those things are critically important too, and sport is one of those things as well, because not everything, and I find this now as somebody who spends too much time checking Twitter and things like that, that I'm worn down by the certainty and the absolute insistence that this is the correct path for, you know, justice and righteousness, and right is on one side here, and that will ultimately lead to this way only is the way that where there will be a better life. And, like, you know, this is not to say that we can't ask for more to be happening from governments and society, but ultimately there is a great need for other things in our lives as well. And I think, you know, when you go on, when you look on, and I don't know why I've jumped onto Twitter, except I feel like attacking it, but when you go on there, I don't feel like attacking it, I feel like attacking the certainty that, you know, exists on it. And, like, for example, a couple of weeks ago, I saw on a Sunday night that story about, you know, the hospital giving out the vaccines to the family members. It was a Sunday night. And I saw that and I went, okay, that's an interesting story. Probably best overall that they gave those vaccines rather than wasted them. You know, probably a few questions need to be answered, but probably best that you don't want to waste any vaccines. And then by Monday morning, I got up and I just, you know, apparently, like, it was, you know, there was just a war going on again, like a war going on about this. A war had been started, and it was Monday morning. It was 7 o'clock on Monday morning, and again we were at war, and you know, with such certainty about everything. So I think now maybe it's a form of escapism too. Maybe Twitter is the thing we all will have a collective memory of, and we'll look back and say this was our Italia 90 was how we fought the pandemic in 2020, 2021. But I do think those things, like, I know what you mean about Jack Charlton. I thought Niall Quinn saying that, like, Jack Charlton, like, paved the way for the peace process, that was probably the most, the biggest leap. But yeah. I also think I it would equally be wrong to deny its importance. It doesn't mean that it remains or that importance is permanent, but I think, for example, on Jack, that it was really important, and I never felt this idea that he was an honorary Irishman was correct. It was actually more important, he was an Englishman.
Yeah.
And when I go back and I talk about my own experience, that love of English football that I had, and I loved English writers, and I loved English music, and all those things, and that cultural overlap that people in Ireland have with England, Jack Charlton allowed that to express itself in a way, because here he was as a kind of Englishman, not coming in and not doing, not trying to be Irish, never trying to kind of, I saw Frank Sinatra, I saw Frank Sinatra play in Dublin once, and his son was leading the band, and his son held up his drink and said, "Sláinte," and Frank just looked around and said, "That's not my racket," he said. And I really like that. I love that, like, the refusal to pander to, you know, the kind of part of anyone, and like where they say, "Let's hear you say it in let's, like, the Queen speaking Irish. Let's hear you do something in our language, and then we'll feel validated."
Yeah.
And Jack came in as himself and remained himself, and that was important.
Yeah, like, there's a story, I mean, just to, on the opposite side, because it twinged a story in the back of my mind of managers coming into jobs and trying to adapt to the people around them. Like, Brendan Rodgers went up to the more leftist Liverpool football journalists and introduced himself as, "Hello, comrade." Just like, you know, it's like Brendan Rodgers, like, owns most of the homes across Liverpool. Come here, on Irish football, I do want to ask you, because you did one of the great John Delaney interviews in the Sunday Independent after Euro 2012, where Delaney brought this massive file of all the things that they were supposed to have achieved in Poznan and across Poland and Ukraine. But obviously it was dominated by the fact that he was a dishevelled disgrace, being hoisted high by drunken fans. As it all came crumbling down for John Delaney in 2019, did you miss being on the Irish football beat? Did you wish to be there to see it?
I possibly would have been like, yeah, maybe. Like, again, with those stories, you know, there's also that just professional jealousy of, like, you know, the look at the stories that Mark Tighe and Paul Rowan have got, and but at the same time, I think it would be very hard for me to say I miss watching Ireland play Gibraltar in Gibraltar. You know, there would take a lot
you
can always just, it's like all these things with Irish football, there's always a moment when the game starts and then the
news stops, yeah, and it starts, yeah, yeah, again, and once, yeah, the, and, you know, once the game, so,
like,
is over.
And if you talk about sport being a great, you know, way of, you know, manner of escapism and concealing the void, like, that is not the case with Irish football. Like, it just reminds you that life is futile and has no meaning. So no, I don't think I ever quite like that, but I did feel that. But I also, truly, and I don't know Mark Tighe very well, but I know Paul Rowan, and beyond the and we're talking about journalism, so I can go into this rather than go into details of the story. I was delighted for Paul Rowan, because I think he's an outstanding, like, if you want to go back to that sense of being outside, marching to your own drum, if you like, following your own path, doing your own thing, and having to deal with that, like, Paul Rowan did that, you know, and he stepped outside and And you know, and I will tell Paul Rowan stories along with everybody else, because he you know, in doing that, he also, I don't think he would mind if I said, you know, he can sometimes reveal, you know, some eccentricities in doing that, but it's that which allowed him to get to what he had to do, and when I interviewed them for the currency, we talked about this. He also had to deal. I think Frank Fitzgibbon talked about this in an interview with Tom Lyons in The Currency as well recently. They had to deal with an awful lot of shit. Like, you know, apart from all the legal stuff, the actual John Delaney going to the offices of the Sunday Times and asking Frank Fitzgibbon to take Paul Rowan off covering Ireland, which, you know, you're basically saying, well, you don't care what this is this guy's job. We don't want him doing this job anymore. So that kind of pressure was put on him. So I was, I couldn't be happier about who was getting that story. And I was, you know, like we'd all been here, like we'd not all been here, but the amount of times I felt this will be the tipping point, you know, this will, and I do think that part of the reason there was a tipping point this time was because of how badly they handle it. Handled it in a very characteristic way, but, and you know, if the High Court judgment had gone the other way, it may have been another one that they just handled that way. But the number of times I thought, right, we've got a tipping point here, things are going to change now, or this is going to be the moment. And even not even little things, but I remember, and Paul had this story too, and I had been very close to publishing the story about the Goldman Sachs payment, and we didn't run it one weekend. We felt we didn't have enough, and then the trail that I had kind of went dry, and I thought that was a huge story, this exceptional payment to Goldman Sachs, because of the way the deal had been structured, and because the FAI backed out of working with them. And I know this was a huge story, because it was such a staggering amount of money. And I remember I was in Brighton on my brother's stag on a Saturday night, and Frank Fitzgibbon tweeted the Sunday paper, his stories in the Sunday Times. And one of them was, this was a few weeks after I hadn't been able to get the story done. It was like Paul Rowan on the FAI payment to Goldman Sachs. And my heart sank, because I was like, this is it. He's brought down the FAI here. This is a huge moment. And there was nothing. There was absolutely nothing. Nothing happened in the back of it.
And is that, to use a phrase that was coined in the Sunday Independent, official Ireland just turning their backs to it?
No, I think actually it's legal Ireland having made its mark over a number of years, and the defamation laws being what they were and are in Ireland, that people are wary of following up any story, were wary of following up any story that they didn't actually have themselves either, because of the consequences if they did it. And the difference with because of the injunction and everything like that, it changed the dynamic of that story, and it propelled it into an area where people were able to talk about it, in a way that, if the Sunday Times had run a story without the injunction, would there have been a follow-up? Would people on the Sunday radio shows been happy to talk about it? Because a lot of the time with certain people in Irish life, when stories appear about them, there is such a fear, of what they will do from a defamation point of view. And that fear is well-founded because of what they have done. And Delaney operated like that, and you know, you're always obliged to say he's legally entitled to protect his good name, and he was legally entitled to protect his good name, as he was legally entitled to go to the Oireachtas Committee and not speak. But the defamation laws were what, rather than official Ireland, I think, you know, they were the reason that those things never gained traction. And to me, that is a hugely important thing. And it doesn't, like, you will see a lot of comment online about the FAI, you will hear people say, oh, you didn't call them out. Where were the journalists then? Where was the... and, you know, as somebody who was quite close to Delaney and then did that interview and wasn't close to him anymore, I can see it from both. I can see both sides of it, but I think there were definitely not both sides of it in terms of both. I think, you know, it's valid to say why weren't more people asking certain questions, but lots of people were trying to ask questions. Lots of people look, read Champagne Football, look what happened to Paul Hyland. Dan McDonald did a lot of good stuff in the Irish Independent. There were people asking questions, but it was hard for people. The libel laws in Ireland don't make it easy, far from it, to actually pursue those kind of stories without feeling. And it's not a question of people. Oh, if you're right, people don't understand libel. They don't. It's nothing to do. It's a cost. It's a function of your budgets. It's a function of your costs. Anyone can fight a libel action if money is no object.
I remember in 2016, I was working at Bulls.ie at the time, and Joe, I suppose, were one of our main rivals in the sense we were in the same market for advertising and so on. And then I read that you had left the Sunday Indo to go there, and I'm thinking, oh, well, fuck it. How you've obviously moved on from Joe since. How do you reflect on those few years?
Well, kind of great, but a lot of, I guess, a lot of fondness for a lot of the stuff that we did, and then, like, sadness for how it ended, and, you know, when it ended, it's, I don't mean for me personally, but just what happened to the company and people's jobs over the last, you know, well, from, you know, 2020, and, you know, the causes of that would upset me and make me angry still. But I don't, going there and doing the stuff we did and the people I worked with in terms of editorial, and people like Paddy McKenna, Conan Doherty, Carl Kinsella, Ellen Coyne, people like that, who I worked with, like, I'm incredibly proud of working with them, and then doing things like Ireland Unfiltered, hugely proud of that. And so, you know, it was definitely the right thing to do. As I said, there is a law of diminishing returns in terms of how many times I could watch Ireland play Georgia. So I was happy enough from, you know, if that was the only part of the deal, I probably would have taken it. So to actually have been able to produce and do exciting work and do things that, you know, I look back on proudly, it was great. But, you know, it was time to leave as well.
We'll finish up with our two stock questions we throw at everyone. Actually, sorry, I do have one listener question that I did want to throw at you. Is Arthur O'D asks, what does a Sunday journalist do for the rest of the week?
Come on. I'm also not, I haven't been a Sunday journalist in years. Once I stopped becoming a Sunday journalist, I did start admitting that they didn't do much.
You got to make her calls and keep yourself informed.
Do we have one more piece of writing to pick as well, or when do we do that?
Martin Johnson, who is not a former English rugby captain and coach, but is a cricket writer.
Yeah. The reason I picked him was because I read a lot of Martin Johnson, and the piece I picked wasn't really that was a bit of a later piece. The only piece I could find. I was trying to look at his stuff online, but Martin Johnson was a very, very funny colour writer on cricket, and he was one of, like, I think, like, he was one of those great, and, you know, Barney Roney does this now, and Marina Hyde, and, you know, when she writes about sport, but also writes about Brexit or the Tory party, but he was fantastic at bringing calamity to you in a way that was so funny, and it was just a glimpse into that sense. Like, I think in Ireland, an awful lot of the time, our failures in sporting sense were always kind of framed as some kind of epic, you know, again, like, and I admire him, but like Eamon Dunphy, like everything was an epic failing of character and of, you know, it was, whereas, like you would read Martin Johnson, and the time I remember reading him was during the 1989 Ashes series in England, which I think England lost 4-0, and they ended up picking something like 29 players during the course of the series. And Johnson just chronicled, like every day or whatever I could, I would pick up the paper just to kind of see what kind of shitstorm had happened the day before. And, you know, and I have a line in my head, which is always lodged in my head. They, towards the very end, like Australia were advancing this, they went very firm with this principle. They were going to have a right-handed, left-handed opening batting partnership, which was a key thing for them. It meant you had to, the fielding team had to change their field, and, you know, you'd move around. It just made things harder for fielders to settle, and it just made, they could kind of pick up runs all the time. And their coach, Bob Simpson, really believed in this right-hand, left-hand combination. And towards the very end, after they picked all different players, England, I think they were following on, and Ted Dexter, who was a great cricketer, was now chairman of the England selectors and was just fumbling through it and stumbling through it. And I always remember this Martin Johnson piece where they followed on in the second innings, and they sent in David Garr to open. And Dexter went to meet the journalists to explain why they were opening with David Garr, and he said they'd convinced themselves of the merits of the right hand. And Johnson wrote it like this: the merits of the right hand, long pause, left hand combination. And this was at the opening of the England innings. And then Johnson's next line was: the long pause was a consequence of the sight of David Garr's off stump tumbling into the field, because he'd been bowled, I think, in the first over. So as Dexter was explaining this philosophy, the philosophy was already coming to an end on the field.
Oh, God. English sporting philosophies are usually more short-lived than any other countries.
When I was looking up Cronin, there's a great line in Cronin where he talks about how sport, unlike literature or politics, is something where you can kind of make a definitive judgment. Things, the truth is kind of revealed. And anyway, I always loved those Johnson. It was a glimpse into how calamity is actually, well, you know, is great material and is great entertainment as well. Like, if you don't take it too seriously.
Okay, final two staccato questions. Most interesting place you've been with work. We ask these to everyone, by the way, and everyone. Well, most people hate them.
There's a few places, like, all the World Cups I did, especially Brazil and South Africa, I'd say were really interesting. Azerbaijan, because it was very weird. I'd say South Africa, because it was just so, again, it was so fascinating, and it was like, there's always that thing with World Cups where it's always trailed as like, this is going to be terrible, or this is going to be awful, or this is going to, you know, the country isn't ready for it, and, you know, FIFA are parasites and all these kind of things, which are true. But then you go and you find yourself just drawn in, and, like, you know, it becomes, you just kind of, if you're there for the whole thing, it just becomes, you know, you just get so wrapped up in what it means to the country. But I'd say South Africa in some ways.
And our final question is: the most interesting person that you've met through work?
Oh, God. Gav, I should have, you asked me, did I want these beforehand? And I don't know. I don't know. Like, that's, I'm trying to, like,
So I offer a preview to everyone, and almost everyone always says, "Ah, we'll go on the right spot," and then, like you, they regret
A friend of mine who was a school teacher once asked me, would I talk to her students or pupils? She was like, it was in London. She thought like third class or something, and would I talk to them about being a sports journalist? And you know, again, it's answered the question about what a Sunday journalist went in. So I went in, started explaining to them about my week, you know. Mondays, sacrosanct. Don't touch them. Don't work on a Monday. And then Tuesday, start making a couple of calls, whatever. And, you know, this was a primary school in London, and I could see that, you know, I was losing them. I was really losing them. And then one of them stuck up their hand and said, do you know Wayne Rooney? And I had this moment where I was like, well, what do I say here? I don't know Wayne Rooney, but like, what's going to get me through? What's going to, you know, do I go back and tell them about, you know, the calls with like, you know, the desk and like, anyone get back to you yet, you know, or do I just this half an hour a bit more entertaining? So I said, yes, I do know Wayne Rooney. And then the next half, do you know Steven Gerrard? I was like, yes, I do know Steven Gerrard. And the next, do you know Frank Lampard? Yes, I do know Frank Lampard. And they answered me, just the time went with them asking me who did I know, and I pretty much lied about every one of them. And at the end, I got a round of applause, and they queued up to get my autograph, because I think they thought I knew all these people. So I would say quickly, actually, I would say Mourinho, covering Mourinho during his second spell at Chelsea, when it was all going wrong in 14, 15, that season. That was great. Like, people talk about press conferences and the waste of time that they are and all that kind of stuff, but actually, they were great.
Yeah, those questions from that third class kid is essentially the format of this podcast. So huge respect to him. Thanks so much. That was really brilliant, and I hope you enjoyed it. And cheers for putting in so much effort with your picks.
Thanks, Gavin.
Thanks so much to Dion, and thanks as ever to you for your support of the show and the 42 at large. It's greatly appreciated, and well, it goes without saying, but I'll say it anyway, that we wouldn't be here without you. Quick reminder to get in touch with the show: email behindthelines@the42.ie or tweet me. I'm @gcooney93. You can join the conversation with fans of the show, trade reading recommendations, and submit questions for future guests by joining the WhatsApp group. To do that, just follow the instructions in the episode description of this podcast. Otherwise, we will be back next week with another great guest here on Behind the Lines. But until then, take it easy.